This is episode number 767 with Olympic legend, Greg Louganis.
Welcome to the School of Greatness. My name is Lewis Howes, former pro athlete turned lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you an inspiring person or message to help you discover how to unlock your inner greatness. Thanks for spending some time with me today. Now let the class begin.
Christopher Reeve said, "A hero is an ordinary individual who finds the strength to persevere and endure in spite of overwhelming obstacles." John Quincy Adams said, "Patience and perseverance have a magical effect before which difficulties disappear and obstacles vanish." Welcome to this episode. We have the legendary Olympian Greg Louganis on the show, who is one of the most decorated Olympic divers of all time, arguably one of the greatest divers of all time, LGBT activist, humanitarian, author, and designer who has won gold medals at the 1984 and 88 Summer Olympics on both the springboard and platform. He is the only male and the second diver in Olympic history to sweep the diving events in consecutive Olympic Games. And in this interview, we talk about his historical Olympic run and what it took to be a champion, the mindset of a champion. We talk about how Greg felt winning was needed in order to feel loved or being worth of love. Powerful insights there. We talked about how he handled having HIV when at the time it seemed like a death sentence. Also, the power of sharing your weakness to reveal your strength. This is a powerful episode. Make sure to share it with your friends. LewisHowes.com/767. Tag myself at Lewis Howes and tag Greg on Instagram as well to let us know what you enjoyed about this the most.
I don't know about you, but when around 3 p.m. hits, I find myself craving the right refreshment to get me through that mid-afternoon slump. New Pure Leaf Zero Sugar Sweet Iced Tea is full-flavored sweet tea, but without the sugar and the calories. It might take several bottles for you to believe that a delicious sweet tea can really have zero sugar and zero calories. But you know what they say, life is full of surprises. Or in this case, full of flavor. New Pure Leaf Zero Sugar Sweet Iced Tea. Try it to believe it. For 20% off your next 12-pack, head to Amazon and use promo code 20PureLeaf. That's promo code 20PureLeaf for 20% off. We've all been there. You have a question about your credit card, you call the number for help and can't get a hold of anyone if you only had a Discover card. With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. A real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card. Okay, quick math. The less your business depends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite, and you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/greatness. netsuite.com/greatness. Again, head to netsuite.com/greatness.
Big thank you again to our sponsors today, and I'm so excited about this one. Again, make sure to share with your friends. Let me know what you think over on Instagram. Take a screenshot of this podcast right now. Post it over there so we can connect. And without further ado, let's dive into this with the one and the only Greg Louganis.
Welcome, everyone, back to the School of Greatness podcast. We have a living legend in the house, Greg Louganis.
thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You're one of the icons in the Olympics, greatest diver of all time, and you just had an incredible life story. Beyond, you know, being an Olympian, multiple gold medal winner, I'm still sad that you didn't compete in, what was it, the 1980 Olympics? Wasn't there a boycott?
Boycott was 1980. That was the Moscow Olympics.
So you were 16 when you did the first Olympics in 76.
Yeah.
And you were just like taking over the world by storm. You got a silver medal then, I think. Is that right?
I got a silver medal there.
16 years old.
Then I was world champion
two years later. And you should have won like two medals in the eight. What was that like during that time where, did you want to boycott or was it
No, you just had to. Well, what happened, I mean, because I was one of the team captains for the diving team. And so the team captains all from all the different sports got together and we were kind of addressing this because we were in D.C. and we were going to have a chance to talk to President Carter and all that. So it was our feeling that we had such a strong team in 1980 in swimming and so many other sports. So we wanted to go send one person into the opening and closing ceremonies and everybody stay back in protest, but go over there and kick ass, basically. So that was what we wanted. But our voices were never heard because as soon as President Carter made his address, then the media was escorted out and then we were able to give our views and let our voices be heard. Unfortunately, our voices weren't heard. But you live and learn. I kind of think back on it too, is that in some ways it might have been a blessing for me.
Really? Why?
Because in 1980, diving was something I was good at. It wasn't something I was necessarily enjoying.
Why weren't you enjoying it?
Well, because I was in theater. I was looking forward to pursuing my acting and going on that, whether it be New York or, you know, because most of it was theater. So
you were a dance major, theater and dance major, right, in college?
Yeah.
So this was your college years, actually.
Yeah.
16, and then, so you'd be 20, 21.
Yeah, I was 20.
Interesting.
And so had they happened, had I been successful, I probably would have gone on.
Wow.
You know, and who knows? I mean, who really knows? You never know.
Wow. I just feel so bad for all the people that have their one chance.
Yeah.
They train for 10 years, 20 years for one moment.
Yeah. I mean, the way that I like to explain it to people is when you think of an elite athlete, it's like a carton of milk. They have an expiration date.
Yeah.
And it's like if you go past that expiration date, you're out of luck. I mean, you miss that opportunity. And there were so many talented athletes that missed that opportunity.
That didn't make it the next in 4 years later, right?
Yeah.
So you were lucky to make it the next two Olympics.
Yeah.
Some people didn't make it at all, though, right?
Right.
Was there anyone else that you knew from the 1980 time that did come back and had a successful experience and were like, got their redemption type of moment?
I'm not sure because I think he was just coming up, Rowdy Gaines.
Gotcha.
I think Nancy Hogshead. There were a few individuals that kind of were able to hang in there and stick it out. But it also depended on the sport, too.
Because,
I mean, if you're a gymnast,
you have like a one-year, two-year window.
Yeah. I mean, on the women's side, young ladies are, they're young.
That's devastating. That's going to be so hard, and that's your whole life's mission. And then you just get kind of robbed of it.
Yeah.
What was the greatest lesson you learned about yourself during that time?
Greatest lesson at that time?
Yeah.
80 to
yeah, in,
what, 80
in the 80s when you got a taste of the Olympics, you get silver and you're like, "Okay, I'm going to win the gold next time." And then, "Oh, I have to wait eight more years."
Yeah. That was really really tough. I mean, that was a hard pill to swallow. I wasn't sure if I was really going to be able to keep motivated.
Stay training, right?
Yeah, because, I had started diving with my coach, Ron O'Brien. That's who from 78 to 88, he was my coach. And the one thing that he was incredible at is really keeping me motivated. I mean, he devised games. I mean, we played games. And it's like anything, you get good at what you practice. Mm-hmm. And so one of the games that we used to play was the 700 game on 10-meter platform. And I didn't like to do repeats of my dives, so if I could get out with just doing one apiece, then I was golden. So in order to break 700 on 10-meter platform, I had to do all 10 dives in the 8.5 range. And, you know, I had to average 8.5 scoring 8.5 on all 10 dives, but the average. So
who was the judge?
He was the judge.
Gosh.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was interesting because sometimes I was successful, sometimes I wasn't. Mm. And one time, at one practice, it was gale force winds blowing into the platform. And it was raining and all that. And he said, okay, we're going to play the 700 game. I'm like, oh, cool. You know, so I get all warmed up and ready to go. And I start going. And I got through. I was jumping back and forth over that 8.5 line. And I was like really, really close. And came in the last dive and got it. I was like, oh, great. Awesome. You know, I was successful. So packed my bag, left. Showed up at the pool the next day. My coach pulls me aside. Ron says, you know, you're the only one who got in the pool yesterday.
Wow.
And I was like, wow. You know, because you have to put yourself in diverse situations in order to be able to practice at a very high level so that you're prepared. So I always, what a lot of athletes, a lot of divers would look at as obstacles, I looked at it as opportunities. Mm. You know, that was an opportunity to train in miserable weather. Wow. How successful can I be? It's not about perfection. You know, perfection's unobtainable. But how close can you get to that mark of perfection?
Right. Except that time you got all perfect tens, right?
I did that a moment, few times. Yeah, you know, but even
you could always get better. You could always get better.
Yeah, even still, I would always say that we can come back to the pool five minutes, 5 weeks, 5 months later, and the scores will change.
You're right, it's true.
You know?
It's true. It's all based on like what people are feeling that moment and what they saw and their perspective.
Because a 10 is really emotional. I've judged before, and it's like, you know, in order to, you have to be touched emotionally
moved by the
performance.
Not just the technicality of it. That's like 9.8. If it's a perfect technically, 9.7, 9.8.
Yeah.
But it's when you see the emotion probably of the diver, right?
Yeah.
Or the moments and the validity.
I mean, I think there's some people who would argue about that, but you know, I think it really is. I mean, your tens are kind of more on the emotional side. You know, wow, that was awesome.
Gotta be, right?
Yeah.
Wow, it's amazing. How would you approach your dives at the Olympics versus at practice? Would you set up and prepare like it was an Olympics or World Championship every single time you stepped on the platform?
Not every single time. Not every single time, because there's different cycles of training. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you're just trying to get the numbers in.
Get reps.
Get the muscle memory of doing the dive, of the execution of the dive. There are other times where the focus is on the performance. You are incredibly focused. That was one thing that one of my earlier coaches, Dr. Sammy Lee, he taught me in preparation for my first Olympics in 76. He would always set up this situation. Okay, Klaus DiBiase is beating you by 12 points. Mm-hmm. You need 8.5s, 9s on this. And it was like, okay. You know, so I'd get all drunk, you know, ready to go. And sometimes I was successful, sometimes I wasn't. But putting myself in that frame of mind, that mental state, allowed me to practice and rehearse so that when I showed up, that was the first Olympics that I'd ever been to.
Crazy. At 16.
I mean, that was the first world stage event that I had ever been to.
You didn't do a world championship?
On the senior level.
Sure.
I did as an age group diver.
Right.
You know, this was like the biggest stage. I mean, it's the Olympic Games.
Wow.
But I was groomed. I was prepared for it.
Wow.
So,
and you got the silver.
Yeah.
Were you close to getting a gold?
Yeah. Actually, one of the judges, R.J. Smith, he was a judge for that Olympic Games, and he came to me, and I missed my ninth dive. That's basically what happened. And he came over, and he thanked me for my ninth dive, because he said, if you didn't miss that ninth dive, then we would have had to protest the scores, you know, because wow. It was... You know,
it's political. It was this.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you have politics in there. I think diving is probably one of the more objective, subjective sports, but it's still a subjective sport.
Yeah, like gymnastics, right?
Yeah. And also, you know, and this is what I tell the athletes that I work with in mentoring them is that even in prelims, it's your responsibility to educate the judges, to show the judges that you're worthy. You're worthy of getting the eights, nines, tens.
How do you show them you're worthy?
Is it by your performance?
Your performance? Is it the energy? Is it how you approach as well? Or is it just only on results?
It's results-based.
Yeah.
Because you, all the good wishes in the world aren't going to make things happen.
Yeah.
So,
but is there like an
wishful thinking?
Is there like an energy that when a diver, you know, if they miss and they put their head down and they're angry, does that make them less desirable of getting good scores? Is it kind of how you show up with your poise and your energy, or is that?
I think that's a part of it, most definitely, because no matter what a judge says, as soon as you walk out on the board and the focus is on you, you're being judged.
Absolutely. So, everything.
Yeah.
The way you walk, the way you hold yourself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And so when you were there, when you were 16, what was that first dive like? First world stage at the Olympics.
The interesting thing was I won the Olympic trials in both 3-meter springboard and 10-meter platform.
Wow.
Basically what I believe happened was the top divers, they put pressure on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
When you show up to an event, I mean, there is an energy. Now, if you interpret that energy as pressure, then you're more apt to implode. But if you interpret that energy as inspiration, that is what motivates you, drives you to be better than you ever dreamed you could be. So if you tap into that inspiration, then you're going to see a lot more success.
How did you learn how to tap into that inspiration or love feeling as opposed to pressure or fear?
Well, I started dancing when I was a year and a half. And I was performing on stage when I was 3. So when you hit the stage and the music starts, there's no stop. It's like, oh, sorry, I missed a step. No, you can't. You gotta muddle through, fake it till you make it, you know, get through. And so you learn that mentality. And I think I was just that was so ingrained in me that I was able to learn how to utilize that energy of all of these people. Oh my God, they're looking at me, you know. And especially as a kid, you know, you're really self-conscious. And it's like, oh my God, everybody's watching. So then the elation is in the performance and the success in the performance and then the applause at the end.
Right.
So, I mean, that's tremendously rewarding.
Wow. And you were adopted early, right? When you were
9 months old.
9 months old.
I spent my first 9 months in foster care.
Wow, that's crazy.
So, yeah.
Where do you think you'd be if you weren't adopted? What would your life look like? Would you be a diver? Would you be a dancer? Would you be, you know, all these things you're doing? Would you be?
I don't know. I'd probably be a surfer.
A surfer.
I don't know.
Do you ever think about that? I wonder.
I connected with my biological father. So he's Samoan and he's in Hawaii.
Wow.
And I have a brother and 2 sisters, half siblings. It was interesting because when I first met Fuvalli, it was after the 84 Olympic Games. And so I was a little
24
skeptical.
At this time?
I was 24.
Wow.
And so then I met Sherilyn and Geraldine and Malcolm. And Malcolm was in, I think he was in weightlifting at the time. And then he went into bodybuilding and then powerlifting. So he was quite the athlete. But I was water, he was on land.
Yeah.
But I always knew, because where I was adopted, Home of the Guiding Hands, they said, one of the nurses who had met my parents, I guess, or she said she did, stated that my father wanted to raise me.
Mm.
And so
that's nice.
Yeah. So I always knew that he wanted me. That also goes back to the Samoan or Polynesian culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what families do. They don't give up their children. It may be a relative or somebody. It stays in the family.
Wow. Yeah. So, the grandmother. Or,
yeah.
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 Do you feel like you were driven to achieve at such a high level because of being adopted by any chance? Do you feel like that was a part of like a driving force? Like I'm going to prove these people wrong or show them anything?
Yeah, I think it was a combination, whether it be, adoption, my sexual identity. I mean, it was any number of things that were really contributing factors into that desperation of having to succeed.
Wow.
Early on in my diving career, because I was being called sissy boy and, nigger and because of my dark skin.
Wow.
And yeah, it was really challenging growing up.
There's not many young boys are doing dance and theater and diving.
Yeah, it's like, that's a sissy sport.
Yeah, right. Right.
So,
especially back in the 60s, 70s, yeah, right.
Yeah. When I was getting beat up at the bus stop and my father drives by and getting my face, pushed into the asphalt, I felt like my father felt the same way that these other kids did.
Your biological father or your adopted father?
My adopted father.
You felt like he felt the same way?
That I was worthless.
Really?
That I was a sissy boy and all that. Because I didn't know that he never got involved with my dance, acrobatics, gymnastics.
So you wouldn't come and watch or support?
Yeah. Not that I knew of. Mm-hmm. But when I took care of him the last 6 weeks of his life, he died of cancer. He shared with me that when I was performing, then he would sneak out of work and come and watch.
Wow. Oh my God.
But I never knew.
That's
he never
beautiful.
Told me or
That's
he
beautiful.
Never shared that with me until, he's about ready to die.
Wow.
So
what was the greatest lessons you learned from your parents, your adopted parents?
I think the greatest lesson that I learned from my mom, because she was my champion. When you're that young, you don't have mentors, really, you have champions, and she was my champion. And she taught me about unconditional love. And it wasn't just words.
She embodied it.
She embodied it. She was, that's who she was to me.
Wow.
And I asked her some questions about, some of the challenges that I had with a sister that I was raised with. And she said, that's your sister. That's, she is who she is, and I love her, unconditionally. It's like, oh, okay. So, I mean, it really kind of solidified that it is possible, that unconditional love is possible.
Wow. Doesn't mean you have to agree with everything that someone does be excited about certain decisions or choices they make, but you can still love them.
Yeah.
Okay, so the unconditional love from your mom.
Yeah, unconditional love from my mom.
And your dad?
One of my favorite parts about my job is that I get the opportunity to travel a lot. And in fact, I'm recording this right now while I'm in Mexico. And actually, I was thinking about something that I wanted to share because I get a lot of questions from so many people about different side hustle ideas. So here's one for those of you out there that are on the go a lot like I am or traveling a lot. When you're staying in your Airbnb on your trips, have you ever thought about how you could be making extra money by hosting through Airbnb while your home is vacant? If you're interested in an extra stream of income, Airbnb hosting is an easy place to start, and it's like giving your home some company while you're away. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. So listen, we all know life is full of yada yada, like those quote unquote free trials that somehow still charge your card for something, or when companies have those sneaky gotchas hiding deep in the fine print. And I know you've dealt with yada yada before, like those bills that keep going up and up for no reason at all, or when budget airlines promise a cheap fare but then charge you for every little thing until you realize you're paying more than you would have somewhere else. And yes, it is possible to outsmart yada yada, like triple checking airline deals to make sure all you need is already already included, but you don't take yada yada in life, so don't take yada yada from your wireless provider. Metro by T-Mobile has no contracts, no credit checks, no surprises, and nada yada yada. Stop by one of over 6,000 Metro stores nationwide. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. Like when you're trying to buy tickets for the best seat at your favorite team's big game, or when you're hiring for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. With ZipRecruiter, you can find qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I believe finding the right team member is one of the most important steps in setting up my company for success. We like to ensure our new hires will be a good fit before they're even on the team. So I am grateful that I have ZipRecruiter's help when we want to grow the team fast. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
My dad, he was more of a skeptic. So it was, you know, be cautious, look before you leap kind of thing. Wish I had learned that lesson a little bit better, because I kind of like jump into things.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, what was I thinking?
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. What were the qualities that they embodied that inspire you to be so driven? Towards all of your activities, not just diving, but do you feel like they guided you to being a champion, or were there other outside factors or internal factors that?
I think initially there were a lot of internal factors, and that was, you know, proving myself. Like I said, when I first started on the world stage in diving, that came from, my success came from a very desperate place. In order for me to be loved or worthy of being loved, I had to win.
And I know the same feeling.
And I was trying to gain the respect and love from my dad.
Really?
Yeah.
You didn't feel love from him growing up?
I felt like it was conditional.
Unless you succeeded, then he was proud of you?
Yeah, then maybe he might be proud of me.
And how?
But you felt that way?
I felt that way, not from my parents, but from like everyone else around me. Like I didn't have friends growing up.
Yeah.
I was the youngest of 4, and I was just picked on and bullied a lot. I was like this tall when I was 10 years old. I was like this gangly, goofy kid. And I couldn't read and write until I got into like late high school.
You have a learning difference?
Yeah, dyslexia. Now that it's, you know, so I didn't know what it was then. Yeah. I just remember being like, why can't I read this? And I just reading over and over and being like, I don't even remember what this paragraph says.
Right, yeah.
And horrible and test taking and just memorization, everything about school was a disaster until 3 o'clock when sports came around.
Yeah.
And that's where I channeled all my energy.
Yeah.
It's like something I could finally understand, just a ball and putting it into like, it's like something simple.
Yeah.
And learning how to just have vision. I had great vision. I knew where to be.
Yeah.
But I didn't know how to read and write.
Yeah.
And so I just got made fun of a lot.
Yeah.
For being in like special needs classes. So,
you know, it's interesting because there are so many incredible athletes. Bruce, now Caitlyn Jenner, she has a learning difference.
Right.
Jackie Joyner, Kersey, you know, there's some incredible athletes that have really made their mark on the world stage. And talking with a lot of them growing up, we didn't feel, and you may have felt this way too, that you didn't have your academics, but you could show people
something,
that you
my
could
worth.
Do something.
Yeah.
That
Absolutely.
You had value.
Absolutely. And that's why I had to win at all costs, too.
Yeah.
I was a horrible loser.
Yeah.
When I lost, I would just be miserable to be around for days until the next competition.
Yeah, because I'm sure it was the same way that I felt, too, is that my training, my competition was a reflection of my self-esteem.
Yeah, your self-worth.
So when I was successful, then yay, I'm on top of the world.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm not successful, I'm worthless.
I think that's a challenge because we're so conditioned to acknowledge the people who are succeeding in business or their career or mm-hmm. having successful relationships or sports. Yeah. And we put so much of our self-worth into our self-accomplishments.
Right.
As opposed to the progress we make or the generosity we have or the right. kindness in our heart or right. the positivity we bring.
Yeah.
And it's just so hard because
everything... Has that evolved for you?
I think it has. Yeah, for me it has. Over the last 6 years, I've gone on a much deeper journey where yeah. I achieved everything for the first 30 years of my life. All my dreams I went after, I was achieving. I was a professional football player. I made millions of dollars. I had, you know, beautiful girlfriends. Like all the things you're supposed to have as a, yeah. like a straight man, right? It was yeah. like that makes you successful. I was achieving.
Yeah.
But feeling so miserable and suffering inside.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand why until about 6 years ago. Started to go on a journey and heal everything from my past.
Yeah.
Talked about sexual abuse I went through when I was 5 from a man that I didn't know. Talked about when my brother was in prison for years and all the, you know, just the struggles in school, my parents getting divorced. For me, there's a lot of people who've gone through a lot worse. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was a lot to deal with at the time.
Yeah.
And I never addressed it because... Yeah. As a straight white man in sports growing up, you weren't allowed to express it without being called.
You're not given permission.
Not given permission.
Yeah.
There was no groups to talk to about. You couldn't.
Right.
If I tried to open up to guy friends, they would just be like, get off me.
Yeah.
Wussy, girl, yeah. whatever. You know, any name.
Yeah.
And that's just a challenge. It's just hard to, yeah, feel like you can express yourself.
Do you find yourself kind of going back and forth sometimes over that? Embracing of like all the parts of yourself.
Yeah, I go back and forth, but I only go back for moments.
Yeah.
And then I'm
just
so
moments?
Quick for so quick to aware That's be right. aware and be like, okay.
Yeah.
I'm living in fear, I'm living in anxiety, I'm living in the past, I'm living in hurt.
Yeah.
Like what can I be grateful for in this moment? And that's why gratitude is a huge part of my life because when I'm in gratitude, it just fills my heart with more love than fear and pain.
Where did you get that lesson?
I think a lot of suffering, where a lot of like breakdown, where I finally was like, I've been doing this podcast for 6 years. I've been interviewing some of the world's greatest spiritual leaders. I've done meditation retreats and just tons of emotional intelligence workshops. And I think through taking action on diving through the pain and the emotions and communicating, the realizations have been coming up.
Yeah.
And I've been practicing it over the last 6 years. So I learned about these things 6 years ago.
Right.
Practicing it daily is something that's challenging to do because I can go back into a bad place.
Do you schedule that in your
every morning?
Every day?
Every morning
it's
I have
kind
a routine.
Of a habit.
Yeah, at
it's
night.
A routine.
You know, my voicemail when someone calls me, my first thing is, if you want to leave a message, you have to tell me what you're grateful for first.
Yeah.
So throughout the day, I'm always expressing gratitude and journal about what I'm grateful for at night. You know, I'm talking about these. They're constant reminders in my life. And I think it's challenging because as an athlete, I think you could understand and appreciate this. We're so used to like going after the next big competition or the next big event. What's the thing that we can chase after and win? And when there's no big competition, it's like, how do we value our self-worth? How do I identify with that? So I've learned to more focus on like what I can control, my health. Like, did I show up today and take care of my health? Yeah. Did I do a tough workout? Did I eat well? Was I kind to people today? Mm-hmm. Did I do something in my mission, which is part of this show? Did I interview someone and really tap into their heart and spread that message to help people?
Yeah.
Like, what are the things on a daily basis that I can control? The Olympics, you know, I haven't made the Olympics. I'm on the USA team for the last 7.5, 8 years now. We haven't qualified since 96, since it was in Atlanta.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, am I worthy even though I haven't qualified for the Olympics? Yeah. It's just like constantly being a reminder of like every day I have an opportunity to grow. And if, as long as I focus on growth, then I feel good within my heart.
Yeah.
That's what I focus on. So it's not easy.
No, it's not.
It's not easy.
Yeah.
And even someone like you, I bet it's really challenging because there's so many guys in the NFL that I know who are living in the glory days of their past. It's like, I used to be this great athlete. I used to get all the recognition. And I can only imagine, I almost like, I have some Olympic friends that I feel somewhat bad for.
Yeah.
They had all this fame when they were 18, 20, 22. the world stage, and then they don't know what their identity is anymore.
Right.
And I can only imagine that is worse than, like, I don't know, not making it all.
Right.
And like constantly progressing. It's like you had the top, and now who are you?
Right.
Have you ever faced that or felt that? Like,
oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, most definitely. I think it's one of those things because it is such a high high.
Huge, right?
You know, yeah. I mean, it's a really high high.
Everyone in the world is watching you.
Yeah. And so it's like, I think it's something that's why I asked, you know, if you go back and forth with that, because it's hard to like mm-hmm. stay on point, stay in that positive, because we always have challenges and mm-hmm. they can come from God knows where, you know, at very different times. But most definitely after I retired from diving, I announced two retirements. I was supposed to retire after the 84 Olympic Games.
Wow.
I was totally dead set. I got my two gold medals, Olympic gold medals. I won the nationals right after that. So it was a record number of national titles from any other diver. And then I was going to retire. But the thing was, in 84, I was one of the athlete representatives that was pushing to have trust funds put into place for the younger divers so that they could continue diving after college and have the financial means to be able to do that.
Because they're making no money.
They're making no money.
Nothing.
So I went to the president at that time of USA Diving and I said, look, you know, I was a part of the athlete reps to have trust funds put into place. What's going on? And his response to me was, well, you're the only one that it affects and you're retiring, so we don't have to put the money into getting the trust funds put into place. I said, fine, I'm not retiring. Do your homework.
Wow.
And so it was my intent to stay eligible until the time that trust funds were put into place for the younger divers.
Wow,
because
that's cool.
At least I will have done something for the younger divers coming behind me.
Yeah, the legacy.
Yeah. And so...
Wow.
As it turned out, it took 2 years to get done. Trust funds were put into place, and I found myself at the World Championships. I was successful. I won the World Championships in 3-meter springboard, 10-meter platform, and my coach turns to me and says, well, it's 2 more years.
Can you stick it out?
Yeah. But it's like, okay, more years. I can wrap my head around 2 more years. And so I hung in there for another 2 years. Never did I, in my wildest dreams, would I realize what that meant.
What did it mean?
6 months prior to the Olympic Games, I was diagnosed HIV positive.
Right.
And so...
It was extremely controversial at that time, right? It was a very...
Yeah. Oh, no, you didn't say a word about it.
I mean, being gay at that time was like, you didn't talk about that, right? Yeah. I mean, it's just like, that was looked down upon and all these things, right?
Well,
socially not acceptable.
Because it was interesting because I was out to my friends and family, you know, once I went to college.
Right.
And so, but then after the 84 Olympic Games and I signed on with the William Morris Agency, they're like, well, Craig, tone down the gay thing. I was like, oh, okay. So it was my policy not to discuss my personal life with members of the media. I mean, there's plenty to read between the lines. You could figure it out if you read enough articles.
Sure, sure.
And I really didn't. Cares because the people who I cared about knew. But HIV, oh my God. I mean, my thought was when I had my test sent out and we did it under an assumed name. And my thought was before I got the test results back was I was dead set that if I was HIV positive, then I was going to pack my bags because I was training in Florida at the time. Pack my bags, go back to California, lock myself in my house and wait to die.
No way.
Because that's what we thought of HIV at that time. It was a death sentence. I mean, people weren't lasting more than a couple years after their diagnosis. I mean, we had friends dying right and left. So that was my thought. But my cousin, who was my doctor in Florida, he convinced me to stay and train that would be the healthiest thing for me. And
really?
I was
so you got
really
the test.
Grateful.
You got the results back, and he said, "Stay and train."
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
That he said that he wanted to treat me aggressively, and he'd take care of the medical stuff, and Ron O'Brien would take care of the, you know, the diving stuff, and also it was easier for me to focus on something like diving because it was a lot more positive.
Yeah.
I'm really grateful for that because at least I had the diving that I wasn't focused on, oh my God,
I'm dying.
HIV, yeah, I'm dying. Yeah. So I had something positive to focus on. So I think that that really enabled me to learn some coping skills surrounding that my HIV status and all definitely was the healthiest thing for me.
How did you stay focused when you thought like, I'm gonna die in mm-hmm. 2 years? Does any of this even matter? Training, the Olympics, how did you stay positive and focused when seemingly the worst thing that could happen happened?
When you're in that zone, flow, whatever you want to call it, I like to refer to it slipping into that space between air and time. Mm-hmm. You know, that nothing else exists. It's just that moment in time. So, and it could be joyful because it was something that was familiar and it was, I'd experienced this before. Mm. And so it was very inviting. That's like with the visualization work and imagery work that I do as well. That, I mean, I love to play in my imagination. And in my imagination, these other things don't exist. Mm. So the only thing that exists is right here now, in that moment.
How did you handle the emotions of your heart? Of like seeing, I don't know, whether you got the phone call or you open the letter and it says HIV positive. What did your heart do? I mean, did you feel like exploding? And how do you cope or process that to not just go down this destructive path?
I think it's almost impossible not to go there. You know, that
destructive path. So you did go there for a while.
Yeah, for a little bit. Yeah, for a bit. But fortunately, my cousin came over to where I was living.
It's your doctor, too?
It was my doctor.
Yeah.
And he delivered the news. And then at least I had somebody to talk to. And so we talked and talked and talked. And it's like, okay, you know, well, I had this certain idea in my head. And he shattered that. And
what did he say? There's certain drugs you can live with. There's...
Well, the only drug that we had at that time was AZT, and you had to qualify for it. And so my T-cell count, I think, was 214, and you had to be under 200 T-cells to qualify for it. But I think the next test that I did, it was under 200.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I qualified.
That's good.
But I met with Anthony Fauci at the CDC. He was great, very supportive. I had a very small group of people who knew about my HIV status because we were learning. You know, we were learning as we were going. Yeah. So any of the medications that I was being prescribed, we had to make sure that my doctor, my cousin, he would call the Olympic Training Center to make sure that none of the medications were on the banned substance list. Obviously, AZT, they're looking for performance-enhancing drugs, and AZT is not a performance-enhancing drug, quite the opposite.
It's hurting you, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's quite toxic.
Wow.
And so, it was interesting.
Wow. Who was the most influential person within the year after you learned about having HIV in your life that supported you? That, like, you couldn't have got through without this person?
I probably have to say that there were three individuals. I didn't want to tell my parents, so they didn't know until years later.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because I didn't want to worry my mom. I figured if I were to get sick, then I could tell her, so she wouldn't have to stress over it. But the three people who were really key in my ability to stay positive was my coach, Ron O'Brien, dear friend of mine, Debbie Sean. She's an attorney, but she was like my big sister.
Yeah.
She's Dr. Sammy Lee's niece. And then Kathy Sean, her sister, mm-hmm. who was a doctor. So a lawyer and a doctor, I'm covered, right?
Right.
You know, but they actually took me into their home.
Oh, that's and nice.
When I was going through some tough times, trying to leave an abusive relationship.
Right. Yeah, right about that.
So
yeah.
they were there for me and opened their doors to me and kind of got me on my feet.
And was it this, let me know if I'm not supposed to talk about these things, but was this relationship, this abusive relationship, how you got the AIDS, HIV?
You know what, a lot of people want, I mean, even my dad, when he was alive, you know, he wanted to blame Jim. But honestly, I believe that I was probably infected prior to
really?
Jim.
Gotcha.
I think we both came into the relationship positive.
Wow.
I don't know because I wasn't tested at that time.
Right.
But my previous partner before Jim, he passed of complications with AIDS.
Gotcha.
And so, you know, my suspicions, I think that a lot of us that were exposed before we, even, obviously, yeah. Before we knew about safe sex or
wow.
anything like that.
Sure.
And I remember doing an interview with Larry King. He's like, how does a smart guy like you get HIV? He's like, I don't understand the question. You know, because I didn't, because we knew about safe sex after. Mm-hmm. You know, and
after having it, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I mean I thought I was in I'm a serial monogamist.
sure.
You know, so it's like when I'm with somebody, that's
with
it.
Them. Yeah.
Yeah. And so
wow.
I figured I was probably safe.
Is what it is. Yeah.
Life happens.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So can you educate me on AIDS right now, HIV? Because everyone was dying, I guess, within a couple of years, but mm-hmm. now there's certain drugs and medication you can take to extend life very long, or what's?
Generally, can even if you seroconvert, you can look forward to pretty normal life expectancy.
Really?
People are, you know, dying of old age, you know,
right,
heart disease
right.
and arthritis and, you know, I mean, they're having issues with, that come with old
other
age.
Other challenges.
Yeah.
But you're having a long life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they've found how to attack the virus in various ways.
Without attacking the rest of your body?
There's still some, it's really hard. The medications are hard on your liver.
Really?
So I do acupuncture and Chinese herbs to support, for liver support and
wow.
immune systems.
But you look great. You look young. You look vibrant.
Oh my God.
You look healthy.
Can you believe I'm almost 60?
It's crazy. You look amazing.
Oh my God.
I hope
next
this,
year I'm going to be 60.
I hope I look this healthy at 60. You look fit. You're joyful. You're full of love. I feel like, so you've been living with this for 30 years. Is that right?
Yeah.
30 plus years.
31.
And so you have to take a medication daily? Is that the essentially?
Yeah. The drug regimen that I'm on now, it's in the morning and the evening. So I've got my HIV meds. I have, let's see, three meds in the morning, three meds in the evening. But I do a lot of supplements, Chinese herbs. And
it's like that helps a lot too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's more of a holistic approach.
Yeah.
And also, like I said, a lot of the medications that they're metabolized in the liver, so it's really hard on the liver. So you
wow.
need that liver support.
And yeah.
So I learn more from my Chinese herbalist
I'm sure.
and acupuncturist than I do my regular doctor.
That's funny.
You know, he's like up on, you know, where I'm at. He even called me yesterday to go over my labs.
Oh, that's cool.
So,
what is the biggest challenge you feel like you've faced your entire life?
The biggest challenge I've ever faced in my life?
Your whole life. Would you say that was like one of the biggest challenges you faced, or was there something else you've been through?
The biggest challenge. That's a hard one, because once you get through that door, it's no longer a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I was diagnosed with HIV, you would think, that's... But once you get through that door, then you realize everything's okay. Losing my father, taking care of him the last 6 weeks of his life. I mean, that goodbye, that was a challenge, because we had come so far because we didn't always have the best relationships. Mm-hmm. And then we made peace with each other in those last, actually that last year.
Wow.
Because he was diagnosed with cancer and I came out to him about my HIV status. And so it became a crusade for life and quality of life.
Wow.
We had many conversations about that. Losing my mother, that was tremendous loss.
How did that make you feel?
It was, I think in some ways it's harder now than it was then.
Really?
Because when you're going through it, you're in the heat of it, then you're taking care of everybody else and not always taking care of yourself. I think it's, I mean, I still talk to her, write her letters, you know, to this day, and she passed in 04.
Wow.
So she had a tremendous impact on me.
Wow.
So.
What's the thing you love about her the most?
Her laugh.
Hmm.
Yeah. I think that's what I miss the most, is her laugh. You know, because, you know, she was genuine, she was real with me, and not afraid to, I mean, we had this connection. It was really bizarre. It was like, you know, when I was way at college, it was like, okay, I got to call mom. And then I call mom and it's like, oh, and she's, something was going on.
Mm.
And actually it was the, she was on the verge of asking for a divorce. So, or actually my dad asked for the divorce. And then she was, she said, okay. I think he was expecting her to like, no, I didn't.
Yeah.
So, and she said, okay. So that was kind of turmoil for her. And I just sensed it. I was just like, you know, it's like I called her and said, well, I knew that there was some reason why I called. So, yeah, we just had that kind of psychic connection. It was amazing.
Wow. Of all the accomplishments you've had, mm-hmm. from sports to activism to theater and movies and other things you've done, what's the thing you're most proud of?
I think the thing that I'm probably most proud of, there's so many things. I mean, I reached out to Ryan White when the People magazine article came out about this young boy who is a hemophiliac who contracted the HIV virus back in 87, I think it was. Mm-hmm. He experienced a lot of hate. Because, you know, any hate or anger or anything like that stems from fear, from a place of fear. So I reached out to him and his mom and invited him to a national championships in cool. Indianapolis. And I felt like if people saw that I wasn't afraid of him, then, you know, maybe they wouldn't be so afraid. Wow. So, there's those types of things. Oh, probably, I've said this in the past, is my book. Breaking the Surface,
mm-hmm.
because when I was on book tour, I had numerous people come to me and say, you saved my life. And whether it was about surrounding HIV or their sexual identity or an abusive relationship or, you know, whatever it was, or being bullied. Because when the book was being published, my feeling before I went on book tour was I was sharing my weaknesses. You know, it's not very manly or masculine
right.
to admit that you were raped or that you were in an abusive relationship or that you were gay or
right.
that you have HIV or, you know, so I felt like I was, or suffer from depression.
Right.
So I felt like I was sharing my weaknesses, but when I was on book tour, I realized by sharing my weaknesses, I was actually sharing my strength because not everybody can do that.
It's challenging.
Yeah. And so, but I find that being able to let go of that stuff, that judgment and all, and living your life, living your own truth, I mean, it's a daily challenge, but it's you're more apt to embody that truth,
yeah.
That you can move through life with integrity, you know, that you do what you say and say what you do and be true to it. It's so hard for other for people to do that.
But
the first person that you really, like the first, when you're coming out, the first person you have to come out to is yourself. You know, the first person that you have to be honest with and brutally honest with is yourself. So once you accept that truth, then you can, you don't have to apologize for anything. You can just be.
Yeah. Wow. Was it hard coming out to yourself?
Yeah.
How old were you? When you came to yourself first?
Well, I mean, I think I knew that there was, I didn't put sexuality to it. I think I knew when I was really young.
Like six, seven, whatever.
Five, yeah. Probably, you know, I think I knew that something was different. I didn't put sexuality to it. It wasn't until later, and then, you know, you're going through puberty and, you know, junior high, and all the guys are talking about all these conquests, and it's like, oh.
You're like, didn't care at all, yeah.
Okay, is that, you know, and then later on, you find out they weren't doing anything.
Right, right.
And then I realized I was doing it.
Yeah.
It's like, I was doing everything that they were talking about. I thought that's what they were doing.
Sure, sure.
So it's weird. Yeah, also giving up the, you know, the idea of needing validation.
For what? Validation?
For anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, that you're good enough. It was funny because, like, I was doing a dive camp in Arizona. And I had a bunch of little kids. And, you know, I told them, you know, be do something kind for Mother Earth, anybody. You know, but and not look for any recognition. You know, do it, don't tell anybody. You know, just do it for your own inner peace and validation to yourself. And so I said, even if it's picking up a piece of trash or complimenting somebody or, you know, being supportive, just being there, an ear. You know, listen.
Right.
You don't have to speak. And so, you know, we were at a lunch break. We was just finishing up our lunch break, and you know, I'm going around and I'm picking up trash. And one of the mothers of one of the kids said, "Oh my God, you really do that stuff, don't you?" I was like, "Yeah. I mean, that's what. Why wouldn't I be? I mean, because ultimately, we have to be examples. I mean, I learn by example." I mean, I'm also sober. Yeah. So I've been sober, what, 12, 13 years, coming up to 13 years. My sponsor is, I never told him he was my sponsor for years because I learned by example.
Yeah.
And what he would say in his classes and share and his journey, flaws and all, that's where I learned. You know, that he lives it.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to do too.
Yeah, be the example.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you're teaching about visualization with these at these dive camps or any other athletes you're training one-on-one, how do you translate what you learned and experienced visually with imagery, because I believe in visualization. I did it for many years. How do you translate teaching that emotion, that feeling to get in the flow? What do you tell people?
Well, the first thing with visualization, and I learned through trial and error, because I learned visualization when I was three.
Wow.
You know, and that was, I'm sure by accident, my dance instructor said, okay, visualize yourself. You know, no, she didn't say visualize. She said, okay, imagine yourself doing the routine. And she played the music, left the room. I was only 3 years old. So I was like, okay, you know, that's how I interpreted it. And so that's how I learned visualization. And then later on, I learned relaxation exercises when I was going through puberty. It was like, you know, I was suffering from anxiety and stress-related stuff. I also had asthma. What I learned in teaching visualization to dog agility people, ballroom dancers, water polo players, divers. I had to start with relaxation. I had to teach them the relaxation exercises.
Breathe, relax.
Yeah, take them through the relaxation exercises. Then they would have a better opportunity for success in their visualization work. The one thing when I start somebody with visualization work is that I start with something totally away from whatever activity that they're wanting to visualize.
Mm.
So,
like what?
Well, I have several. I have several kind of fun exercises. I think, let's see, there's a roller coaster ride. There's a horse, riding a horse. Those two, because, okay, it's a wild,
exciting,
wild roller coaster ride. And I try and get them to use all of their senses.
What
are they feeling? What are they smelling? What are they hearing?
Yeah.
What do they taste? You know, because when that adrenaline starts amping up, then, you know, you get dry mouth, cotton mouth.
Yeah, yeah.
And so those, the horse ride and the roller coaster really taps into the adrenaline.
Mm-hmm.
The one that I really enjoy, especially with kids, is I tell them, okay, you're going to bake some cookies.
Oh,
and it's like, okay, pick somebody that you want to bake cookies with, you know, whether it's your mom, your best friend, your aunt, your uncle, whomever, pick whoever it is. So that there's an emotional connection to that person. And then I go through the measuring of the sugar and the flour and the texture of the butter and the smell of the extract, you know, whether it be vanilla or almond or whatever it is. So they go through all of their senses, the sense of smell, taste, and all of that stuff. And I try and encourage them to use all of their senses because you never know what's going to come out to the forefront as far as their strength. And so, you know, that's how I teach visualization, that it's totally removed from what the activity is, because that's important, because if it goes wrong in the activity that they're wanting to do,
it's
going to, then it has a tendency of going wrong in real life.
So you have them practice something, other activity first.
Mm-hmm.
You have them relax, breathe, go through another activity of visualization. Then do you take them to the dive or to the sport after
that? Not necessarily. No, I mean, I let them hang out there.
Mm.
And then it's almost like, you know, they're muscles, you know, that you're flexing and you using to utilize. So the more that you flex those muscles and the more fun that you can have in doing it, the more likely you are to practice and do it.
Yeah.
So then you play along. It's like, oh, maybe, you know, let's try this. You know, they come to the conclusion on their own usually that, okay, I'm ready for this. And then their visualization kind of steps right into place.
That's powerful.
Yeah.
I've never heard someone talk about visualizing another activity first to heighten your senses and then step into yours when you're ready.
Yeah.
So I like that. That's a great, I'm gonna start doing that.
Yeah.
Even when you were talking about making the cookies, I was visualizing measuring the sugar,
okay, what
the
kind flour. Of
they were chocolate chip.
Chocolate chip?
They were chocolate chip for me. I mean, that's what I was.
Chocolate chip or peanut butter?
Snickerdoodle. I was smelling this. Yeah. And then you said the vanilla extract or the almond, and I was thinking of like the mixture of both the vanilla smell and the almond taste, and I was like feeling it. You're barely even doing it. I was just like processing it with my mom and seeing them rise in the oven and taking them out
smell.
And biting this gooey and burning the top of my mouth.
Yeah.
And, and waiting, you know, all this stuff. It's like, I could literally smell vanilla when you said it. It was like, I could taste the sugar and the chocolate melting in my mouth.
Yeah. It's funny because like every time I've done that with kids especially.
They love the cookies.
It's like, oh my God, I got to go to a Subway and get a cookie.
I know, right?
You know,
they're so soft at Subway.
Yeah,
oh my gosh.
So
I got a couple final questions for you. This one's called the three truths. So I ask everyone this question at the end. So I want you to imagine it's your last day many years from now on Earth.
Uh-huh.
But you've got to pick the day eventually and you've got to leave, right?
Yeah.
Eventually it's, you know, it could be 100 years from now. And you've accomplished everything you want to accomplish from your whole life, from now until when that day happens, you've lived the life you want. And for whatever reason, you've got to go. Mm-hmm. It's your time to go. and you've got to take all of your accomplishments, your medals, your books, your movies, they've all got to go with you, the things you've created. Mm-hmm. So no one has access to your content anymore. But you get to write down on a piece of paper and a pen the three things you know to be true about life, the three biggest lessons you've learned, or what I like to say, your three truths that you would share with the world.
My three truths?
Yeah, what would be your three truths?
Nothing really matters except now. Mm. Life is a game, play it. Mm. I have to say, validation is redundant.
What does that mean?
You don't need to be validated. Mm. I mean, if you are true to yourself and authentic, you know, there's no apology, there's just who you are. It's yeah. just who you are. So it needs no, obviously, you know, because I'm very much about love, you know, it's got to come from a loving place.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to be embodied in love.
When do you feel the most loved?
When do I feel the most loved? Sometimes at events with kids when I do some, you know, workshops and I've done some camps there and definitely with my dogs.
Yeah.
My dogs.
Dogs just bring you so much joy
yeah.
to your life.
They give you, that's true unconditional love. And they don't know anything else. So it's either unconditional love or fear. Because in any of the, any aggression or anything like that, it stems from fear.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also train dogs.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
It's very much aware and in tune with, you know, reading those signs yeah. of stress and fear. And so wow. I just want my dogs to be, feel loved and safe.
How do you create that feeling for dogs or humans?
Through games.
Really?
Yeah.
Games for dogs makes them feel safe?
Yeah.
What type of games? Like playing fetch or some other?
I mean, the one thing that I'm going through right now is trying to build confidence in one of the dogs that I have. And so I'm teaching her tricks. So that's always fun. It's fun for me and fun for her.
When she learns a new trick, she feels more confident.
Yeah, yeah. Because it gets her mind thinking and not worrying. It's like, oh my God, what, you know, there's a boogeyman around the corner
right. or
something like that. So that's one thing that I learned in competing in dog agility is that I would always teach my dog, you know, some really solid tricks that they can do at the start line. So it kind of gets them off focused of the dog agility and kind of, it's okay. You know, I can do this trick. I can play around. It's all about fun.
Wow. It's kind of like visualization of another activity for a dog mm-hmm. before the activity itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like roll over, play dead. Yeah. Okay, now let's go do this competition.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. Wow.
You're truly translating what you learned in sports with dogs. That's great.
Well, that was one of the things that I... you know, years ago when I first started with Ron O'Brien, that was one of the first things that I told him. I said, you know, I do better when I'm having fun, when I'm smiling and having fun. I said, you have permission to kick me in the ass if I'm not. And actually at the World Championships that year, 78, he did come up at my practice because the weather was miserable. It was in Berlin. It was rainy. It was cloudy. It was cold. I'm a fair weather diver. I love the sun. And it was just miserable. And so I was just like having horrible workout after horrible workout. And then he came up while I was under the shower, you know, in the shower trying to get warm. And he kicked me in the ass and walks away. And I look, and it's like, I see the back of his head. I was like, oh my God, it's come to, you know, physical abuse. You know? And then at this facility, they had an elevator. So I'm in the elevator going up to the 10 meter. And it's like, oh, duh. I told him he could kick me in the ass
if I'm
not having fun. And so I started laughing. And then I, you know, got my scowl face on, you know, I was like, looked down and said, okay, watch this. And I did my front 3.5 and I nailed it. Wow. he goes, well, that's more like it. And it's like, so it forced me to turn a corner.
Yeah.
And cool. It was a great lesson.
That's why I think your truth about life is a game, play it. I think if we're not playing in our daily lives, if we're not being playful, if we're not having fun, if we're not expressing joy, it's so much more serious. And as you know, as an athlete, you can't get into flow without having fun.
Right.
Without being relaxed.
Yeah.
Without being playful.
Yeah. Well, that was when I hit my head on the diving board. Everybody likes to bring this up. That's all they remember, me hitting my head on the diving board. But I did come back and win, so I can't be the agony of defeat.
Sure.
But that was the one thing. If you look at the clip on the very next dive, I set the board. They announced the dive. You could hear an audible gasp from the audience from where I was standing. So it kind of told me that they were afraid for me. Mm. And I was afraid for me, too.
Before you went into
the... Before I went to... After that, the next dive after my hitting my head. Because it was in the same direction. And so I took a deep breath and I patted my chest, you know, because like I felt like my heart was pounding outside my chest. And then the people around who saw that chuckled. They go, oh my God, he's afraid too. You know, we're afraid for him. And so I started laughing. I was like, oh my God, you know, these people, they're in my corner. It's like, oh, you know, so if you're, and J.K. Rowling's got this right in Prisoner of Azkaban, the Bogart. What's a Bogart? It's a shapeshifter that turns into your greatest fear. How do you transform a Bogart? The spell is ridiculous. You make it look really ridiculous. How do you banish a Bogart? You laugh at it. And the Bogart is fear.
Mm-hmm. I love this. This is good stuff. One final question, but before I do, you've got a movie you're working on. There's a movie that's coming out soon. Can you talk about it?
Yeah, it's a biopic. We're working with a production company in London.
Okay.
So, we're trying to get that. We're so close, to getting it.
Is it already finished or is it?
No.
We're working on it right now?
Yeah. We're looking to get it made.
Amazing. So you're looking to get that made right now. What else do you have working on that we can support with?
Luganus.com. You know, you can keep up with what I'm doing. I've got...
Your books are there, everything's there.
Yeah, books there, movies there. And I'm also the sports director for Red Bull Cliff Diving World Series. So
That sounds cool.
The season's going to be starting shortly. So really looking forward to that. Also looking to, I'm pretty sure it's going to be through my website, but an online coaching.
Oh, wow, really?
So, yeah.
Like a diving coaching or like a mental training or like a...
It's mental.
Wow.
Whether it's the relaxation visualization or, you know, to be able to achieve your goals. I mean, it was so funny because like one of our divers, Cassidy Krug, I gave this breathing exercise. When I did the TV show Splash, I gave that breathing exercise. And then she pipes in. I didn't think she was listening. She said, yeah, you gave that exercise to us. And he said, that was the only way I was able to get through the finals at the Olympic Games in London. Using that exercise. So, you know, you know, to be able to achieve what you don't believe in here that you can achieve.
Wow. Amazing. So that's all going to be at Luganus.com, right?
Yeah.
The coaching and everything else. Okay. Well, I want to acknowledge you for a moment for your incredible joy that you bring to the world because you've been through so many different challenges. You've been through what people would think are like some of the worst challenges to go through, things that they would hate to have happen to them. Yeah. And you've gone through them with grace and peace and love. I'm assuming not all the time, but it looks like you've really processed everything that's gone through in your life in such a peaceful, loving way. And you've used the energy to be one of the best athletes ever, to, you know, pursue your dreams, to help humanity. And for me, that's so inspiring. And you're an amazing symbol of love and joy. And I want to acknowledge you for all the gifts that you have in the world. My final question for you is, what's your definition of greatness?
My definition of greatness?
Yeah.
Thinking, acting, and being beyond yourself.
There you go. Greg, Thank you so much.
Does that make sense?
It's a great definition.
Okay.
Perfect.
Yeah. I mean, it's...
You're the man. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There you have it, my friends. The greatness community is taking the world over. We have so many people who are listening to this episode and to these episodes every single week, learning, growing together, connecting. There's a community online of people who are supporting one another. And I want you to get a part of this and subscribe to the podcast right now. If this is your first time here, welcome to the community. Welcome to the movement of people who are dedicated and committed to growth in their personal lives. That's what this is all about. How can we find more fulfillment, more meaning, more purpose in our life with everything we do, with our health, our relationships, our career, our business, and our purpose in life? That's where we're all about. This is episode number 767 with Greg Louganis. Make sure to share this with your friends. You can just send them the link, lewishouse.com/767. Text it to a friend. Message them on social media. Let them know you're thinking about them and you think this might support their journey in life or inspire them in some way. To bring it back to the beginning, Christopher Reeve said, "A hero is an ordinary individual who finds the strength to persevere and endure in spite of overwhelming obstacles." And John Quincy Adams said, "Patience and perseverance have a magical effect before which difficulties disappear and obstacles vanish." You are a hero. You are someone who can overcome ordinary challenges every single day to create extraordinary results. It's all about the consistency of showing up. You don't have to be perfect. You just have to continue to show up each and every day and try to be a little bit better than the day before. You are loved, you matter, and your dreams matter. And I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, thank you so much for being here. And you know what time it is. It's time to go out there and do something great.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You can start your day off right when you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.